Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
World of Secrets, Al-Fayed Predator at Harrods is back with a new episode, following the latest developments in the investigation. Listen now by searching for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're leading the programme with a potentially huge story out of the Middle East. And the key lies in that word, potentially. Because, maybe strangely, it stems from a vote in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, which the Israeli newspapers are today barely covering. Perhaps because there was such an overwhelming consensus in parliament about the move. The move to, in effect, ban UNRWA, the UN's main relief agency for the Palestinians. So why call it potentially huge? Because of the impact some say it could have on an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. And because of the questions now for Israel's allies over this move. Are they going to do any more than continue to express their concern? And because of the questions for Israel about its responsibilities. We'll try and get into all of that today. Our Middle East regional editor Sebastian Usher is in our Jerusalem bureau. Before we get on to UNRWA, what about this Israeli airstrike in northern Gaza that the Hamas-run health ministry there has said has killed almost 100?
Yes, we've been getting reports about this, seeing videos, seeing the images of the dead, the wounded, for several hours now. This is in Beit Lahia, where there have been several strikes like this in the past two or three weeks. The Israeli army has been mounting a major offensive again in northern Gaza to try and prevent Hamas fighters from regrouping there, and it's led to tens of thousands more Palestinians again being displaced and to terrible incidents like this. I mean, it seems that a five-story building was brought down and that much of an extended family who were living there were either killed, wounded or buried in the rubble. And I mean, what makes it worse, if one can imagine, I guess, is that we were hearing just last week about the only remaining hospitals in that area and the difficulties they're having. And the one which deals with this kind of trauma, the Kamal Adwan, is barely functioning now. Most of its medical staff have been taken away for questioning by the Israeli forces, who believe that they may have a connection with Hamas. And we were hearing really heart-wrenching reports from medical staff there about how overcrowded it was, how difficult it was to provide the support, the treatment that was needed for people. And now with this influx we're going to have today from this latest strike, that situation is only going to be worse. From the Israeli side, we haven't really had a full kind of response from the IDF as yet. They're saying they're looking into the reports of what happened.
Just very briefly, Sebastian, in terms of the international condemnation of this move over UNRWA, what do you think Israel's response to that will be?
Well, I mean, one of the senior politicians who sponsored the bill has essentially said that there's no going back. They're not going to accede to international pressure, that it's just, that it's right. And that was the feeling, you know, when it was passed. It passed very, very easily. As you were saying, it really isn't very contentious in Israel at the moment. There is this three-month grace period. I think that is the concession that Israel feels it's made, only if the US does things that are, you know, actions against Israel's interests rather than words, will there be any change?
Our correspondent Sebastian Usher in Jerusalem. Sam Rose is Gaza director for UNRWA. He's currently in Khan Yunis in the south of the territory. What impact could this new law have on UNRWA's ability to operate in Gaza?
If it's implemented to its fullest extent, it would essentially make it impossible for us to operate in Gaza. we wouldn't be able to bring in supplies because that has to take place in coordination with Israeli officials. It further wouldn't be able for us to manage our movements safely in and out of Gaza, across checkpoints, but just in and around conflict zones, because all these movements are coordinated to make sure that it's safe. And thirdly, it compromises staff safety and the protective status of our installations. I mean, their health centers and their health points that are provided this year, they provided 5 million primary healthcare consultations to Palestinians in Gaza. But it's also, we have 300 schools in Gaza, and about 100 of them right now are serving as emergency shelters. So there are hundreds of thousands of people sheltering these buildings under the safety of a UN flag. And if that protected status of those buildings is taken away, then of course we can't in any way pretend to guarantee that safety.
So you mentioned the UN flag, and it's a point I bring up with somebody who is backing the Israeli approach, who we'll hear from later in the programme. But I wonder, and this may be a very naive question to ask, but given that you are a UN agency, could it not be possible simply to transfer your work to another UN agency? Could you somehow get round this simply by sort of changing the logo?
I mean, it's obviously a bit more complicated than that, but the way that UNRWA operates, the way that UNRWA was set up in 1949 and began operations in 1950 is different to the way that other UN organizations operate. We're essentially unique in the fact that we are delivering our services directly. Most UN agencies subcontract to partners who often themselves subcontract to partners. So we manage and we implement all these services directly. And we're not just distributing aid or providing water. We're running a health system. We're running an education system. And you know, one of the most successful endeavors of the United Nations in this region over the past 70 years. But other UN agencies work on policy, they work on normative issues, they provide support to member states and to governments. They're not in the business of running health services or running education services.
I guess what you have been saying is at the root of what has long been a criticism from Israel of the way in which UNRWA operates, is that it's almost like a shadow system of administration which has built up over the decades and which has been the breeding ground for the problems that Israel now says it is trying to deal with.
Yeah, but the other side to this is UNRWA continues to provide services because of a failure of the parties to the conflict to reach a solution to that conflict. And, you know, quite honestly, the fact that we've been able to do this over 60, 70 years through thick and thin, through conflicts, through displacements, you can't blame UNRWA for the fact that there's no solution to the Palestinian issue. And that was why UNRWA was set up, to continue providing assistance and protection until such a time as there is a resolution to that.
And that was Sam Rose, Gaza director for UNRWA. Ahead of the vote in the Israeli parliament, the foreign ministers of seven countries diplomatically close to Israel put out a joint statement expressing grave concern over the possibility of this anti-UNRWA legislation being passed in Israel. Now that it has, how would Hamish Faulkner, the UK's minister for the Middle East, describe his government's feelings?
This vote from the Knesset clearly jeopardises the entire international humanitarian response in Gaza. We've seen over the last days and weeks just how desperate the situation is in Gaza, in northern Gaza and across the Strip. So we are gravely concerned. We'll be working with those seven partners from our statement in the weekend to underline, both publicly as we already have and privately with the Israelis, the importance of ensuring UNRWA's ability to continue to deliver aid into Gaza. There is no alternative to get aid into the Strip at the scale required, given the pressing humanitarian needs there.
Well, you may say that you will press Israel to continue to ensure that UNRWA can do its work. This legislation is intended to, indeed, it mandates the government to stop UNRWA from operating. So
I mean, I wonder what difference it's going to make for you just to say we're concerned and please can you not damage UNRWA?
So, Tim, we've got to be frank about this. We were clear in advance of the vote of our view, and the Knesset has chosen to go ahead, and we are deeply disappointed by that. We, as the Foreign Secretary said to the House yesterday, we are calling on the Israelis not to implement this decision, certainly not in the timelines that of winter, where we're deeply worried about the need to get supplies and equipment into the Gaza Strip. But I'm not going to pretend to you that the vote in the Knesset was welcome, nor that our calls were abided by. Clearly they weren't. That will not stop us in trying to get the progress that we need.
No, I understand that, but I'm at the risk of sort of asking the same question again. I'm struggling to work out how you are going to make that happen, because they paid you absolutely no heed in the run-up to this vote. There have been expressions of profound concern about the state of the humanitarian situation in Gaza for goodness knows how long. That only seems to be getting worse. I mean, for you just to say we're going to work hard to impress upon the Israelis doesn't feel like a plan.
Tim, as I say, we are deeply disappointed by the decision that has been taken, and we will press on the Israelis to change the approach.
Yeah.
We will do everything that we can, both publicly and privately.
From the other end, and we are hoping to get comment from Israel, but I mean, their view is that actually they provided the United Nations with a lot of time to try and sort out UNRWA, which they believe is a profoundly corrupted organisation, and that this aid, which everybody says needs to get into Gaza, could be brought in by other UN agencies. People are obsessed with UNRWA unnecessarily. What's your response to that?
On access, we're absolutely clear more aid needs to be going in to Gaza, and so more needs to be done. And it's not an UNRWA-specific question. More aid needs to be getting into Gaza, and the IDF needs to do absolutely everything to deliver the flood of aid that the Israeli government have promised into Gaza. On the questions of UNRWA itself, we supported the independent review by Catherine Colonna, the very respected former foreign minister of France, and we have allocated £1 million to help implement the recommendations of UNRWA. So we don't accept the premise that UNRWA is broken and needs to be replaced.
Do you think Israel is in danger of becoming a rogue state?
We express our views to Israel on the humanitarian situation, frankly and candidly, but we are also, you know, we are also friends to Israel. We support their right to self-defense, consistent with international humanitarian law. But friends also need to be critical friends. And on this issue, it is absolutely clear that we disagree, and we say so forcefully, publicly and privately.
But does that criticism lead you to warn Israel that taking actions such as this may put it beyond the pale of accepted behaviour by democratic countries?
So I think we've been clear in our statements about UNRWA and a whole range of other questions where we are concerned that Israel is moving beyond international humanitarian law or the resolutions of the Security Council, and we will continue to make those points to them.
And that was the UK Middle East Minister, Hamish Faulkner. We'll be getting an Israeli point of view on all this coming up in about 15 minutes here on NewsHour. Also coming up on the programme, the sound of Manuel Mirabal, the trumpeter in the Buena Vista Social Club, the most renowned Cuban band in recent times. Manuel has died at the age of 91 in Havana. We'll speak to the record producer who brought the band together. We'll hear from him in about 30 minutes. Our headlines this hour, as we've been hearing, Hamas officials in northern Gaza say that almost 100 people have been killed or are missing in an Israeli strike on a multi-story building. And Russian troops have seized more towns and territory in eastern Ukraine as their offensive in Donetsk grinds on. This is the BBC World Service, and live from London, you're listening to NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. It is 1 week to go to the US election, an election the world is watching. You'll have to forgive the cliche, but it is true, the world is watching. We have been getting a sense of how the candidates and the campaign and the whole process are being viewed from different countries. We've heard from China and Russia. Not so far, though, from the United Kingdom. So who better to tell us than the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason?
To everyone's astonishment, the vulgar insurgent has won. So wrote a British foreign minister, Sir Alan Duncan, in his diaries in November 2016, after Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton. Dealing with Donald Trump and his administration was like dealing with no other world leader. He was an American president like no other, writes the former Prime Minister Theresa, now Lady May, in her memoirs. And on the off chance that Keir Starmer thought things might be different this time if Donald Trump wins, the last few days have showed him otherwise. I was on a plane with the Prime Minister the other night heading for Samoa. Spoiler alert, it's a flipping long way. When that accusation of election interference by the Labour Party was made by the Trump campaign. I asked Sakir about it.
This needs to be seen for what it is. These are Labour Party members and staff who are on a voluntary basis in their own time going to campaign in the election. It's happened every election. Every political party does it.
If Donald Trump can kick you around like this as a candidate, what might it be like if he wins the presidency?
I have met Donald Trump. We had dinner together in New York just a few weeks ago. The reason we did that was, I think, a shared endeavour. We both wanted to make sure we had a good working relationship.
The thing is, though, on previous occasions, this hasn't caused an almighty row. It was a reminder that Team Trump can be brash, unpredictable, and have a long memory for perceived slights, and don't appear to really give a stuff about their relationship with the British government. So what on earth might happen if he wins? Until the row in the last week, things had, on the face of it, been going well for the new Prime Minister with his US relations.
Well, I'm going to see him in about an hour, so I have to be nice, right? But I actually think he's very nice. I think he ran a great race. He did very well. It's very early, but he's popular, and I'll be seeing him, and I'll send you regards.
Donald Trump there, speaking at Trump Tower in New York a few weeks back. Keir Starmer and his Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, had managed to get a meeting. The Prime Minister later told me on Newscast what he made of it.
He flew up from Florida, and we both wanted to ensure that we have a good relationship. That was the purpose of the dinner. And
did he feel like a man you could do business with if he was to win?
Look, of course, because, you know, it's up to the American people to choose who they want as their president. And it's up to me as Prime Minister to make sure I have a good relationship with whoever the president is.
Oh, and remember that the now Foreign Secretary once described his host as a woman-hating, neo-Nazi-sympathising sociopath and a tyrant in a toupee. In policy terms, a Trump presidency would likely bring rapid change on climate change, on international trade, whacking up import taxes, tariffs for a start, and on Ukraine. Unlike a Harris administration, they would likely offer a UK free trade deal, but it seems unlikely the terms of it would tempt London to sign up. So what of Mr. Trump's Democratic rival, the Vice President Kamala Harris? The Prime Minister's never actually met her, despite visiting America three times since July. Number 10 blames the pressures on the Vice President's diary in an election campaign. It is worth stating the obvious. She is vastly more of a known quantity and far more likely to be conventional in her approach to high office than her rival. And Sakir has gone out of his way to spend a lot of time with President Biden in the last 4 months. An imperfect way of getting a sense of how his vice president might govern, and with no opportunity to build a personal relationship, but not entirely useless at getting something of a handle on it. One cabinet minister excitedly told me about their plans for how they'd work with a Harris government and what a difference it could make. And if Donald Trump wins, I asked? Goodness knows, they almost said.
And that was the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason. We have an utterly wonderful story to bring you now, made even more wonderful by the fact that it happened pretty much by accident, albeit a very well-educated accident. It's the discovery of a great Mayan city buried underground in Mexico. Its remains were revealed when a PhD student, Luke Auld Thomas of Tulane University in New Orleans, was looking at a data set of radar images gathered not by archaeologists, but by environmental scientists.
The discovery was entirely serendipitous. I read an academic paper that some colleagues wrote where they reanalyzed some environmental data from Mexico, data collected by environmental scientists, and looked at it for its archaeological value. And I thought, that's pretty cool. Where there's one, there's usually more. And so I just set about poking around online and did a deep dive and eventually turned up with this real treasure of a data set. And so we downloaded it and looked at it from an archaeological perspective. And through a very happy coincidence, the survey happened to target an area of great archaeological interest, but about which relatively little was known.
It is a site in the Mexican jungle inland, about 100 kilometers from Calakmul. It's an extensive site with pyramids abandoned in about the year 900. Professor Elizabeth Graham is an expert in Mayan civilization at University College London. Does she think it is, well, first of all, remarkable how the discovery was made?
Yes, it is remarkable. And most of us, I think, are really excited about it because it isn't even so much that they found another city, but that they discovered that most of the area is settled or was settled in pre-Columbian times. So there are houses and smaller towns and other houses on the periphery of the larger site. So many of us suspected this, but it's hard to prove when you work in the forest and you could walk past a pyramid without seeing it.
Yes, what a remarkable thing to think of. But I guess, at the moment, we have to be tantalised, because presumably this is not something which easily or cheaply can be excavated.
No, the larger sites, they're being worked. I mean, the site of Calakmul, the site of Caracol and Belize. But yes, you have to get grants, and it takes years and years.
Yeah, so, I mean, other than the fact that it is confirmation of what you knew or what you suspected was likely to be a very rich area, what do you think we can learn from what has been found so far?
Prior to this, there were some skeptics who... Prior to this, LIDAR was generally site-focused. So, for example, I work at a Maya site, and I would try to raise the money to get LIDAR.
This is light detection and ranging.
Yeah, it's a light, a laser beam is shot at the earth, and because it ignores vegetation entirely, it's wonderful for working in the forest because it will tell you the topography, the ups and the downs, and even caves. It'll even detect caves because it detects the surface of the earth. And that's why when you work in the tropical forest, it's such a gift, because it can detect structures.
And I guess as far as you're concerned, it's just further underlines what richness there was in Mayan civilization.
Yes. I mean, I think despite the fact that there are lots of tourists in the area, I mean, there are 8 to 10 million Maya living today, Maya groups. There's about 28 languages. And yes, they had just a remarkable civilization. But, we forget, or else we think everything has just been discovered, by us. And you don't realize that as much information almost can be lost as gained.
Yeah, the case for humility from Professor Elizabeth Graham from University College London. Much more about this amazing Mayan to be found on our website.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for people.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, we're going to head to Nigeria because it's a country where women can still be accused of witchcraft, an accusation which can destroy lives, at the very least leading to social isolation, but also unemployment and violence. The BBC's Jonathan Griffin has been to meet Dr. Leo Igwe, who uses social media tip-offs to try to locate people accused of witchcraft and so protect them.
I've travelled to Lancaster in the northwest of England to speak to a Nigerian man who's addressing a conference on witchcraft and human rights. He helps people like this.
This fight is too much for me to carry. I cannot continue like this. I'm not walking. I'm just begging for work. They have killed my image.
This is the voice of Nika from Asaba, a widow who says that she was banished from her community in southeastern Nigeria after she was accused of witchcraft. Accusations that she was using killer magic in her catering business have destroyed her income, she says. We've also been told that she was beaten until she fainted. Dr. Leo Igwe says that he was sent a video of Nika lying helpless on the floor and decided to support her. He helps people through his organisation, Advocacy for Alleged Witches. His prevention work focuses on Nigeria, but his work extends to a number of other countries.
There is actually nothing that could make me refrain or stop from intervening. My realization is that I have to step forward and try to provide leadership.
In Nigeria, like in many parts of the world, there is still a fear of witches and witchcraft. The people who are accused are often vulnerable. Some have mental or physical disabilities. It's an offence to accuse or threaten to accuse any person of being a witch or having the power of witchcraft under Nigerian law. It carries a maximum 2-year prison sentence. In 2021, the UN Human Rights Council also passed a resolution condemning human rights violations associated with witchcraft. Yet witchcraft allegations continue to persist in this region. Leo helps support people who've been accused of being witches.
What happens is that when people are accused, they withdraw. You know, socially they're not active. And so what we encourage them is that, what do you need? Come out, dress well, let people know that there are people giving you attention, there are people accepting you. Our work is just to empower the accused person to do what he or she wants to do.
According to Leo, letting local people know the accused has support can often lead to a slowing down of witchcraft accusations. Leo rejects the idea that witchcraft accusations are an African cultural tradition that shouldn't be tampered with. Instead, he says he wants Africans across the continent to disrupt and rebuild societies with the values that they think are best.
We should not romanticize it in any way by trying to say, oh, it's part of our culture. It's not part of our culture. To killing our parents is not part of our culture. Killing innocent people is not part of our culture.
The Nigerian Dr. Leo Igwe, and he was speaking to Jonathan Griffin. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. And back to our lead story now, the Israeli parliament passing by a big majority legislation which bans the UN's main relief agency, UNRWA, from operating within Israel. Our colleagues from BBC Arabic have been soliciting opinions from people in Gaza about the impact that the new law could have on them.
Without UNRWA, people in Gaza will have eaten each other. We are living through starvation. We have children. We have ill people. This is not a solution. We can't take it anymore. We want a solution to stop the war, but stopping UNRWA in Gaza will lead to death.
UNRWA are not any danger to Israeli forces. UNRWA distributes flour, sugar, essentials, and helps people. I've never seen anyone from UNRWA practicing resistance or anything like that. The citizens and residents of Gaza reject this decision from Israel.
Well, we've heard condemnation of the move from both UNRWA itself and from a close ally of Israel, the UK. What's the rationale from within Israel? Einat Vilf is a former member of the Knesset who's written extensively about UNRWA.
The justification is that UNRWA has been the ideological infrastructure that has given birth throughout the generations to multiple Palestinian terrorist organizations. The very reason that we have a conflict now is precisely because UNRWA has been fueling it for the last few decades, rather than allowing and supporting the Palestinians in moving on and building a state for themselves. It has fueled for them the belief that they need to keep fighting so that there's no Jewish state between the river and the sea.
You have said many of these criticisms over a very long period of time. And I know it's in a sense, it's mainstream opinion in Israel that, look, UNRWA helps at the very least to ossify the conflict, that it sort of sets it in stone because it perpetuates the status of Palestinian refugees. Now, lots of people would take issue with that and say that, they're just trying to manage the fact of the conflict. The question is, though, right now, is that UNRWA is the main agency that is trying to deal with an absolute disaster when it comes to the humanitarian situation in Gaza. To cut them off at the knees right now is only going to make the terrible life that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have all the worse.
It's actually the opposite. As someone who's been at it for 20 years, I know that UNRWA always say, we are needed right now, because they always light a fire and then they say, look, fire, we are very much needed.
But they're not with the greatest respect, they are not the ones who are either bombarding the Palestinians in Gaza or who are, as we heard from an Israeli minister in terms on this program, who are blockading parts of Northern Gaza, who are stopping aid from getting in. They are dealing with what, by any stretch, is a humanitarian disaster right now. They are the ones who have got tens of thousands of employees who can help direct that aid.
So maybe it's important to expose the fact that UNRWA is actually, contrary to what the letters UN seem to imply, is not a foreign organization of Swedes and Norwegians who have come to a disaster zone to help. It's a purely Palestinian organization.
It's a UN-mandated organization. I mean, you can be upset about that, but that is the case. And I just wonder whether this action risks putting Israel outside the bounds of international law.
Actually, the very existence of UNRWA and its perpetuation is beyond the bounds of international law.
Except it's not. It has a UN mandate.
No, but what it did, what the Arab refugees and the Arab supporters did in the 50s, is they basically created a legal loophole that allowed them, under the mask of a UN mandate organization, to create a purely Palestinian organization that operates against every international rule about how refugees are treated. And this is why they exist, and this is why they fuel the war. It's actually an incidence of going against international rule.
Einat Vilf, a former member of the Knesset. Germany has today, both in Berlin and through its ambassador in Tehran, protested about what it's called the murder of an Iranian-German national. On Monday, Iran executed Jamshid Sharmad, having found him guilty of leading a pro-monarchist group which was blamed for bombing a mosque in 2008 and was said to be planning other attacks. Jamshid lived in California but was kidnapped 4 years ago by Iranian security forces while in Dubai. Masih Alinejad is a US-based Iranian journalist and activist who last week US federal prosecutors charged a senior official in Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps and three other men of plotting to assassinate her in New York in 2022. What does she make then of the news of Jamshid Sharmad's execution?
To be honest, it shattered my heart because it is very, very personal. I know his children, especially Ghazaleh, his daughter, who has campaigned tirelessly to save her father, but unfortunately now she is mourning. I strongly believe that Jamshid Sharmat's execution is a state-sanctioned murder by the Islamic Republic. Not only me, millions of Iranians believe that after being kidnapped, tortured, forced to do false confession on Iranian national television, and now being killed.
I can understand that there is one level of shock about somebody being executed for the crimes he was accused of. The other thing, though, is that, as you say, he was abducted. He was visiting Dubai at the time.
Yes.
And I guess that that adds a whole level of concern, especially for somebody like you who lives abroad.
Yes, you know, it shows you that miles away from Iran's border, you are not safe if you are a critic of the Islamic regime. Yes, Jamshid was kidnapped from Dubai, and Ruhollah Zam was kidnapped from Iraq. Habib Aswad, a Swedish citizen, was kidnapped from Turkey, and three of them were executed. So to me, this is a slap on the face of European countries who actually thought that they can give a chance to the Islamic Republic, but that shows them right now that this regime cannot be reformed.
You are clearly still a trenchant critic of the Iranian government. You have been for a long time. But given what we learned last week from US federal prosecutors who charged a senior member of the Revolutionary Guard Corps and other men connected with the government with trying to assassinate you, are you having to think about the way in which you live your life?
To be honest, my life now has been like absolutely upside down. I don't have a place to call a home. I have moved 21 times between safe houses. But that doesn't mean I'm going to live in fear. That actually made me more determined to fight back this regime, because I know that I am being protected by the US government. But Jamshid was not lucky. Millions of Iranian women are not lucky. They're facing the same killers. So that's why I am louder than ever, and I'm calling on German government, European countries to take strong actions. Because here now I see, after the execution, the foreign minister of Germany, who actually met recently with the foreign minister of the Islamic Republic, say that we condemn that. German chancellor say that we condemn that. These empty condemnations are not going to save our lives.
The US-based Iranian journalist and activist Masih Alinejad. This is NewsHour from the BBC. We started the programme with Israel's war on a southern border. A brief look now over its northern border with Lebanon, because Hezbollah has today named its new leader. Naim Qassem was the longtime deputy to Hassan Nasrallah, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike in Beirut last month, as Israel has cut a swathe through the leadership of the Iran-backed militia. Correspondent Emir Nader joins me now from Beirut. Emir, what do we know about Naim Qassem?
Hi, thanks for having us. So Naim Qassem is in his 70s. He's been involved in Hezbollah for around three decades. And he's, as you mentioned, one of the deputies under Hassan Nasrallah, who was himself killed towards the end of last month in a series of very heavy Israeli airstrikes here in the southern neighborhood of Dahiya here in Beirut. There'd been some speculation, obviously, that was over a month now. There'd been some speculation about who would succeed Hassan Nasrallah, who was, you know, a very powerful speaker and was seen as a very significant leader within Lebanon and within the region for his leadership of Hezbollah, seen as a strong strategist. And there'd been some speculation that the presumed successor would be a man called Hashem Safieddine. But then, just days after Hassan Nasrallah's killing, Hashem Safieddine was also killed in an Israeli airstrike. And so the next presumed successor was indeed Naim Qassem. There is a lot of speculation about where he is. There's rumors that he may be in Iran, that he may be in Iraq. And I think there's probably the shock of how deeply Israel has been able to penetrate Hezbollah and survey it and gather intelligence on the organization probably goes some way to explaining why so few details about his about Naim Qasem's location has been revealed. Since Hassan Nasrallah has been killed, the Hezbollah has been keen to project that its leadership hasn't been affected, that there is still strategy capability, that their command and control structures haven't been badly affected. And whilst there's been this process of obviously selecting the next Secretary General of Hezbollah, which has been announced today, the fighting in the south of the country and the ground operation against Israel's forces that have entered Lebanon, as well as their firing of Hezbollah's firing of rockets into northern Israel, has continued apace. So still there is that active kinetic fight going on at the ground level whilst the senior leadership have been selecting the next leader who's been announced today, Naim Qasem.
Right. And there's also these reports that the UN peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon has been caught up in the fighting. What can you tell me about that?
Yes, so we understand that around 8 UN peacekeeping troops in the south of Lebanon have been slightly injured today when a rocket hit their position. There's been a little bit more detail that's come out, which is that the rocket appears to have hit the base from its northern side. UNIFIL, as it's called, the peacekeeping mission there in the south of Lebanon, hasn't attributed the strike to any particular party, but some of the speculation is that since it came from the north, it may not be the Israeli side, who have been accused numerously by the UN peacekeeping troops of deliberately targeting their positions in the past weeks. But in this situation, they haven't yet been able to identify or announce who might be the source of that strike on their base today.
Emir Nader in Beirut, thank you very much for joining us. Now, before we end the programme, music to lift the heart, or at least swivel your hips. Sound of Chan Chan, the opening track of the hugely successful Buena Vista Social Club album and documentary about the Cuban music collective. We're hearing it because the man playing that trumpet solo, Manuel Guajiro Mirabal, has died at the age of 91. Nick Gold is the record producer who brought the Buena Vista Social Club band together in 1996. What was it about the man and his trumpet playing?
He was a wonderful man and had an encyclopedic knowledge of Cuban music, but was very, very deferential and quiet guy. I mean, he was just music all the time. If he wasn't playing, he was whistling or humming a song. And when we made the Buena Vista albums, for example, on Chan Chan, that was the very first track we recorded, and he would have been very quietly in the corner of the studio sitting with his trumpet in a chair while the sound checks were happening, bits of rehearsals were happening, and then the track would be recorded, and he played that amazing iconic solo. No one had heard the solo before because he just kept it to himself until the track actually went down. And the whole record was like that. We didn't know what he was going to do because he was obviously listening and reflecting in his head what he was going to do. And every solo on that record is just, I think his performances are as iconic as the individual singers are.
I mean, it has that tremendous immediacy, the whole album. But also, and I really mean this as a compliment, it's not meant in any sort of undercutting way, but it is so simple. The lines that he produces, and like that scale that begins that solo, it's actually a very difficult thing to have that level of musical directness, isn't it?
I think that's very true. And he did it on every song. There's so many iconic moments from him on that album, the solos in Dos Gardenias, the solo on De Camino a la Vereda, on Cuarto de Tula. They are deceptively simple, but they're like meant to be. They're almost part of a composition, even though a lot of them were improvised. He couldn't then change them because the audiences were desperate to hear what they'd heard on the record.
I mean, you put together this band, which was just this runaway sensation globally. And then they toured, they became known through the documentary. Was that something that he embraced?
I have to say at first, it wasn't just me. It was a whole collection of people were responsible for bringing it together. But he loved touring. He loved being with the band, and he loved the camaraderie of it. He loved traveling the world. But he didn't like stepping outside and stepping up front. And even his solos on stage, you know, the audience would clamour for him to step forward. But he was very reluctant to. So he was a very, very shy man.
Sad day to be thinking about the wonderful music that Guajiro produced. How will you remember him?
He made me laugh, and he was very, very affectionate. I saw him in March. Just gone, and he was living at home. He was very much a family man with his wife and relations. I felt very comfortable with him. He was a dear man and a great artist and a great craftsman. He was extraordinarily talented man.
Nick Gold paying tribute to Manuel Mirabal. We'll end with this piece from him, Dombe Dombe. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and the Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.